today about axions, who are a very curious particle from beyond standard model. They have a very small mass. They are very weakly coupled. Nonetheless, theorists love them. And although that mass is of order the mass of a neutrino, it's a cold dark matter particle. And that's the aspect that is going to interest me today, in the case particularly of the QCD axion. Okay, so for the case of the QCD axion, it's essentially a one-parameter model where the couplings to standard model particles are proportional to the mass. And that's what I will focus on. So the outline of the talk is I will start it by reminding you why the QCD axion was introduced to solve the strong CP problem, then tell you the story of the universe in the case where the axion is born after inflation. And in that case, there are two contributions to cold dark matter, two non-thermal production mechanisms. One is going to be the misalignment field, and the other is going to be axion particles produced by strings. And both of these are going to redshift like cold dark matter. Now, of course, dark matter is supposed to do more than redshift, like 1 over the scale factor cubed. So in the third part of the talk, I want to discuss how axion dark matter could grow large-scale structure. And the interesting question here is whether it can be distinguished from WIMPs in large-scale structure data. Now, this talk is supposed to be understandable, but I don't exactly know who I'm talking to. So if I go too slowly and you're bored, feel free to throw tomatoes or something like that. And if I'm going too fast, please slow me down by asking questions. So the axion was initially introduced to solve a problem in QCD, which is that if you write the Lagrangian, and it's here in black, okay? So the QCD Lagrangian, as we normally write it, has a kinetic term for the gluons, where here the index A runs from 1 to 8. It is for the 8 gluons. And then there's a kinetic term for the quarks, who interact with the gluons via their covariant derivative. Now, the offending term, who is responsible for the strong CP problem, is this GG tilde thing, which if you wrote it in electromagnetism, it would be E dot B. Now, we all know that the magnetic field doesn't flip sign under parity, which means this E dot B thing is CP odd. And a coefficient you put in front is therefore CP violating. So it would give you a CP violating gluon self-interaction, which would contribute to the electric dipole moment of the neutron. And so the upper bound on the EDM gives you an upper bound on theta. And so theta is much closer to zero than, much more like zero than it is one. And so that is the strong CP problem in QCD. So if you want to get rid of that theta term, apart from tuning it, you can, among two of the things you could imagine doing, is somehow adding a symmetry such that you can shift that theta term away. Or alternatively, you make theta dynamical, such that its minimum is at zero. And then you have solved your problem. Now, these two approaches are equivalent, but for that, one has to use the chiral anomaly. And in practice, what the chiral anomaly is going to allow us to do, if we assume, in the case of massless quarks, so let's, for 1 minute, suppose that the quarks in the standard model are massless. So if you have a theory with massless quarks, and you were to rotate the left-handed quarks by minus theta over 4 and the right-handed ones by plus theta over 4, then your theta term would go away. And the reason it does this is because although when you write a Lagrangian for massless quarks, you can independently rotate the phases of the two quarks. In other words, there's a chiral symmetry and a conserved current. You know that what the chiral anomaly tells you is that when you do that calculation in a quantum theory, the axial current has this anomalous term theta gg tilde. Okay, now, unfortunately, that doesn't allow us to get rid of theta in the standard model, because if you make this transformation on the quarks in the standard model who are not massless, you pick up a phase on the mass terms. There's a mass missing on the right-hand side there. But it does tell you how you can solve the problem. You need to add quarks whose mass is invariant under that chiral rotation. So you can't add massless quarks, because then you would have seen them. But you can add quarks with a mass that will rotate under your chiral rotation. And the way to do that, now this is the KSBZ axion model. You introduce new quarks. They are the psis in this Lagrangian here. And they get a mass by coupling to a new scalar, who is capital phi. And phi will transform under my chiral symmetry. And that way, the mass term, who is here, when phi gets a bev, will be invariant under the chiral rotation. And when I go to very low energies, which are much below the bev of phi, I have rotated theta away. The radial degree of freedom of phi has become very heavy. The quarks that couple to it have become very heavy. And the only thing I'm going to be left with is the phase of my complex scalar, who is going to be the axion. Okay. So in practice, at low energy, I am left with one particle, who is the axion. It's a pseudo-Goldstone boson of chiral symmetry, or phrased another way, it couples to two gluons. So that means it can mix to the pion. So the lightest mass eigenstate in the mass matrix for the pseudoscalar bosons is going to be the axion with a mass, which is going to be of order 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5 electron volts when I put the vev of my field phi at 10 to the 11 jev. And 10 to the 11 jev is more or less the scale I want to put it at for the rest of this talk. We'll see later why I like this number. Okay, this is going to give me the right dark matter density. Now, you know, of course, a phase has to be dimensionless, and the axion is a phase. But if I want it to have canonical dimension, mass dimension 1, like any other scalar field, that means that when it's in the exponential here, I have to normalize it by some mass dimension, some mass. And the only mass available is the vev of my field phi. So that means that when I either expand this exponential or take derivatives of this exponential, whenever the axion appears, it's going to appear with a factor of 1 over f. And so in its couplings to the standard model, the axion always comes with a factor of 1 over f. And this means the couplings to standard model particles are proportional to the mass.
Anyway, that's not your argument. If it's a real symmetry, then it should be a Goldstone boson. It's exactly massless.
Yes.
So what is breaking the symmetry here? What is making it pseudo-Goldstone rather than Goldstone?
The mass of the pion?
It's not a symmetry, right? It's an anomaly.
I know that, but I'm asking what is causing the break? What is the anomaly of the symmetry that is not breaking it?
Mass of the pion is what gives it a mass.
So what I end up with is my one-parameter, one-particle new physics model, where the couplings are proportional, couplings to the standard model are proportional to the mass. Now, there's one other aspect of this, of the axion, that I'm going to need later on, which are itself interactions. So when it gets a mass by interacting with the pion, what it's really doing is acquiring a potential. And it acquires a Sine-Gordon potential, which if you expand it, you do a Taylor expansion, the first term is going to be a mass term. And then the second one is an axion to the 4. And the point I want to make is that the axion to the 4 coefficient is, first of all, it's tiny. It's the axion mass squared divided by the VeV that's 10 to the 11 GeV, all squared. But it's negative, OK? And the fact that it's negative is going to be important later on. Now, if you add a particle to the standard model, which is very light and very weakly coupled, you know you need to worry about astrophysical bounds. So in particular, the masses we're talking about of order at the mass of a neutrino are lower than the temperatures in stars. So you can produce in various astrophysical objects. And if it's very weakly coupled, it would also be able to escape. So you need to set a constraint such that the production is sufficiently slow, and that is an upper bound on the coupling. Okay? Now, depending on what type of astrophysical object you're interested in, the most efficient axion production mechanism will go via either its coupling to electrons or, in the case of the supernovae, the couplings to nuclei. The different astrophysical objects will give slightly different constraints, but roughly speaking, you obtain an upper bound on the coupling that has to be small enough, and because the coupling is proportional to the mass, you have an upper bound on the mass, which is about 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Okay? So now let's think about cosmology. And so here is a cartoon of our universe. There's some nebulous process which gets called the Big Bang. And the first episode afterwards that we need is a period of inflation. Okay? And this is because if you look at the universe today, you see coherent fluctuations in the microwave background on the size of the universe we see. So you assume the universe used to be a causally connected little volume. And then after inflation, the universe is supposed to be a hot bath and cool progressively, creating the different fossils that we see in the universe today. Now, for the purposes of axions, I'm going to be interested in two types of fossil production. I want to generate dark matter, and then I'm going to be interested in how that dark matter creates large-scale structure, or seeds large-scale structure. So remember the scale of the VeV of capital phi, my parameter F, was big. It was 10 to the 11 GeV. So I have a choice of whether I put that scale before or after inflation, and I'm going to put it afterwards, OK? So the first thing that happens in my universe is that there's going to be inflation. And one of the reasons I want to do this is because if the axion was present during inflation, it would grow density fluctuations, which would turn, it would grow field fluctuations, which would turn into isocurvature density fluctuations in this constraint from Planck. So I'm going to avoid that by having my Petri-Quinn phase transition after inflation. So in each little causally connected volume of the universe after inflation, my field phi is going to roll down its Mexican hat to a particular choice of its phase. And that corresponds to a choice of the value of the axion field. Okay? So in each horizon volume, the axion is going to be random, somewhere between minus pi and pi. And because we're doing this after inflation, the universe today corresponds to very many horizon volumes then. And you can know the average value of the axion field squared over the universe today as a function of F. Yes?
Why are you ignoring the anthropic window where you have low-scale inflation and large F?
Because the concern, the issue I want to address is what happens to the order one density fluctuations that I get on the scale of the QCD horizon when I do this case. So how the dark matter story evolves when I put the birth of the axion before inflation is not as controversial as this one. Now, the price I pay for putting the birth of my axion after inflation is that I broke a U on symmetry, so I have one string per horizon. Now, this situation is the case right when the axion is born. It's going to remain true all the way down to the QCD phase transition. And that's because the axion is a massless field, and you look at the equations of motion for a massless field in Friedman, Robertson, Walker universe, and the Hubble expansion damps density fluctuations up to the scale of the horizon. So of course, the horizon is growing. And as it grows, one patch where the axion has a different value from the next patch, the two come into causal contact, but they sort that out and reach a more or less constant volume value over each horizon volume. And the strings will do the same thing.
By the way, there is a gradient of the axion field around the string. Because as the universe grows and you have Hubble volumes coming to causal contact, you get more than one string per volume, and there is a topological configuration of axion. So in fact, it's not completely constant. There are gradients of the displacement of order, of the same order. Basically, there are gradients in the constant, what you would consider displacement configuration of axions. Because the strings are topological, so there's a topology, there is a 2-pi angle of the axion field around the string itself. No. So there are strings.
I don't think I care. So I think that is going to be part of what is called axion production from strings. Because I am only going to care after the QCD phase transition. So now I get to the QCD phase transition. And sometime just before the QCD phase transition, the pion mass starts to turn on, and it turns on fairly rapidly. Okay? And so that means the axion mass is also going to turn on. So this Mexican hat potential now gets tilted. And this is what gives this sine Gordon form that I was showing you before. Now, as soon as the mass becomes bigger than the Hubble expansion rate, in each QCD volume, the axion field notices that it is misaligned by some amount with respect to zero, and it starts to roll back and forth around its minimum. And the energy density in that oscillating field is proportional to the mass squared times the field value squared. Now, the field value, we know it. Naive, and it's going to redshift as 1 over the scale factor cubed, so it redshifts like dark matter. Now, you might naively think, well, it's proportional to the mass, so the bigger the mass, the bigger the density, the cold dark matter density today. In fact, it goes the other way around. And the reason it goes the other way around is that you only start redshifting after the mass becomes bigger than Hubble. And so it turns out that the smaller the mass, the later it starts to redshift, and therefore the bigger the density. So requiring that you not put too much energy density into this oscillating axion field is going to give you a lower bound on the axion mass, which is about 10 to the minus 5 electron volts. Okay. Now, then there is another source of axions, and this one is more complicated. Since my U1 symmetry now no longer exists because I tilted the Mexican hat, the strings are going to go away. And this is studied numerically by various groups. Sorry, do you have a question? Or okay. This is studied numerically by various groups. What they all seem to find is that within a couple of Hubble times, the axions will go away. There is some discussion about the spectrum of the axions they produce and how many of them. According to the latest Japanese analysis, they get approximately the right cold dark matter density today for an axion mass of order 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. And their spectrum of axions from their strings peaks at momenta of order the Hubble scale, which is much smaller than the axion mass today. In other words, you have made a bath of called modes, called particles, called something. Okay.
Average to give pi squared over 3 is your average misalignment angle. They're also giving you order 1 density fluctuations on scale of order the horizon size.
Absolutely, yes, you're mini clusters.
Right, so you've got mini clusters and it's not clear. I mean, they're a particular type of isocurvature fluctuation with like 10 to the 9 times the amplitude of adiabatic fluctuations, but only on small scales. It's
yes,
not clear to me whether they're a
yes, but the spectrum is
falls off as 1 over the square root of the mass. Whereas compared to the, let me see if I can make a picture. Exactly, and it's a white noise spectrum, so it's falling, right? So by the time you get to large scale structure scales where you see something, you don't care. Now later, when you're way ahead of me. I get to mini clusters at the end of the talk, so maybe we can leave the mini clusters for the end of the talk. But yeah. Okay, so summary of all of this is that I have 2 non-thermal production mechanisms for my axions, which are going to give me something that is going to redshift as 1 over r cubed. Okay. Okay, so summary so far is that I need the mass to be less than 10 to the minus 2 electron volts, such that it's consistent with the world we live in. And if I put the mass somewhere around 10 to the minus 4 electron volts, I'm going to get about the right amount of cold dark, the right amount of stuff that redshifts as 1 over r cubed. Now, what I would like to know is what is gravity going to do with those things from the QCD phase transition until today? Because what I'm interested in is, can I tell the axions from the WIMPs by looking at large scale structure data? So let me start out by telling you a very intuitive story by Sikivi, and he points out that if axions are the dark matter, they're very light, so you must have a huge number of them, and they must have very low momentum. So you have a huge occupation number. You know that when you compute a rate, you have these Bose enhancement factors. So you might think that they'll be interacting fast enough to be in thermal equilibrium. And then they should form a Bose-Einstein condensate. And you can make an estimate of the gravitational interaction rate of an axion. So suppose I put an axion on the end of my finger. It has a mass m, and it's going to interact gravitationally with all the other axions within a volume r. I'm going to set r to be the horizon scale. Okay? And so that's g Newton, density and axions. And there's a 1 over r for gravitational force. And if I set the radius to be the Hubble expansion, sorry, the Hubble radius, in the early universe, this gives me an estimate for the rate, which you can compare to the Hubble rate at the time. And it's bigger for photon temperatures below a keV. So Sikivi concluded that the gravitational interaction rate is fast enough to thermalize the axions, and so they will form a Bose-Einstein condensate. And then we've all seen helium-4 in the lab, right? It forms vortices. So he suggested that vortices in a galactic axion halo could correspond to caustics, and this would be a signature of axion dark matter.
Wait, I mean, he's wrong about this, because the interactions of axions are attractive, not repulsive. You can only have stable vortices, stable solutions of vortices for repulsive interactions. So, yeah.
Yes, yes. So, to phrase it diplomatically, this caused many papers. Now, I find this scenario very confusing. So I don't know what is meant by Bose-Einstein condensate. I don't know where we're talking about fields when we're talking about particles. It doesn't matter. he's obtaining a thermalization rate, which is from deterministic equations of motion, and it's linear in the coupling. So usually when you have thermalization, you expect to have entropy production, and I don't know where that entropy is. So I'm confused, and what do you do when you're a theorist and you're confused? You should always be able to ask the path integral. The path integral is supposed to be an oracle, it knows everything. Usually that doesn't help you because you can't calculate, but remember an axion is this extremely weakly coupled scalar. It's the closest, probably the closest thing to that free scalar field we learned about in field theory that we're ever going to meet. So let's ask the path integral. Okay? Remember, I have these two axion populations that I want to describe. One is the classical field, and one is the particle distribution that came from the strings. And the path integral will tell me that as variables, it likes me to compute expectation values of endpoint functions, right? So you can calculate a thing called the classical field. We all know this because this is the thing, the effective action is a function of the classical field, gives us one particle irreducible Green's functions, right? So my classical field, I want to identify with the misalignment axions. And you know, classical fields are like, for instance, the Higgs-Vev, like the inflaton. And then if you compute a two-point function, this of course gives you a propagator, but if you do it in a closed time path formalism, it's also going to give you the particle distribution, in other words, a phase-space distribution. And this shouldn't surprise you, because we all know in quantum mechanics, you can't know X and P simultaneously at the same point, right? So if you want to get the phase-space distribution as a limit of quantum field theory, you have to start from a two-point function so that you can take a Fourier transform with respect to one of the variables, basically, to get a momentum, okay? So my phase-space distribution of cold axions from strings, I expect to be able to put it here. And then I can also ask the path integral what equations of motion I should use. And it will tell me that I should look at Einstein's equations and I should calculate a stress energy tensor as a function of the classical field and of my phase-space distribution. And then there would be further corrections to that, which are controlled by G Newton and the axion self-coupling. And since both of these are relatively small, I am going to forget about them and focus on calculating a stress energy tensor to put into Einstein's equations. Now, up until now, I've been talking about the path integral. Now, in practice, I'm going to compute these stress energy tensors in the most simple-minded way I know, which is to work in second quantized field theory. I define a state which is a combination of a bath of particles, and I put a coherent state to represent the field, and I take the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. And that allows me to rediscover things that you can find in textbooks. So the axion particles have a stress energy tensor that looks like dust. Just exactly like the WIMPs would have, that's what you expect. And then the classical field, and I've taken its non-relativistic limit, okay? Is going to have extra pressures. And the way you see that is you identify the thing that sits here as the density, and then you identify the rho here as the density times the velocity, and then the question is Tij going to be rho Vibj, like up here, or is there something extra? And there is something extra. It's proportional to gradients of the field and to the axion self-interaction to the four. And so there are important point to notice here is you see, because you're working with a classical field, this contribution to the pressure is linear in the coupling. Normally, if you were talking about particles, if you have a contribution to the interaction pressure, it comes from a scattering cross-section, which goes as the square of couplings, right? But because this is a classical field, it behaves sort of like an amplitude in quantum field theory, and so it has it can have an equation of motion, which is linear in the coupling. And this is actually in an old paper of Sikivi's. So the point here is that the extra pressures you just get from the classical field anyway. This is the misalignment axions. They don't need to Bose-Einstein condense. They're already different. Or phrased another way, usually you describe a Bose-Einstein condensate as a classical field. So I think the misalignment axions already are a Bose-Einstein condensate, and the whole discussion about whether or not they Bose-Einstein condense is something of a red herring. Okay? So let's now focus on these extra pressures and ask, is structure formation going to be different for my due to the presence of my axion field? And let's start with small fluctuations, okay? So in particular, I'm thinking about the density fluctuations that are present in the axion field that it inherited from inflation.
Sorry, let me just a question. Yeah. So I think the real controversial issue is not that whether they are, I mean, classical field, because I mean, that they are by assumption, but then when you form structures, then you have shell crossing. If you have a Bose-Einstein condensate, then there would be just one field value per point, effectively. But then if you, for ordinary dark matter, you have multiple streams and lots of shit. So that the question is, does the thermalization mechanism operate at that point or not? And I think Sakibi claims that it does. But I think that's the point of what happens upon forming nonlinear structures, not initially.
So I'm going to get to nonlinear structure formation in about one slide. Since Sikibi's initial claim was about thermalization at temperature of a KeV, I'm not sure that he was.
But he said below a KeV.
Right, but that's radiation domination KeV. But yes, okay. I do agree. The critical issue is what happens in nonlinear structure formation, because in linear structure formation, the equation of motion you get for density fluctuations when you have extra pressures, or when you have, when you have extra pressures, is going to be the WIMP equation, which is here in black, plus a term where you have the speed of sound, and the speed of sound is the derivative of the pressure with respect to the density. Now, the point is, this term is irrelevant on large-scale structure scales, because K here is the inverse wavelength. And so K is a very small number for the scales that are interesting for large-scale structure formation. Okay. And this, again, I'm rediscovering stuff from the literature long ago. Now, then, as it was already pointed out, there are differences with respect to WIMPs, okay? One is, indeed, there is a pressure. And so this is going to give you a Jeans length, or a Jeans length is defined as the scale at which pressure, the outward pressure force, balances a gravitational desire to collapse, okay? So anything smaller than the Jeans length essentially oscillates, whereas anything bigger than a Jeans length can collapse. So the Jeans length, in other words, where pressure becomes relevant for the axions, is always going to be a fraction of the horizon volume, and it's that fraction is square root of the expansion rate over the mass of the axion. Remember, the expansion rate is decreasing, and it was 10 to the minus 6 of the axion mass at the QCD phase transition, so this is a small number. Then there is this point that the axion field at the QCD horizon scale was random from one horizon to the next. So the density fluctuations are order 1 on the QCD horizon scale. And that is about 5 kilometers then at matter radiational quality, which is when I'm going to care about them. It's about 10 to the 9 kilometers. Now, the point about the reason these things are irrelevant for large-scale structure formation is that the spectrum is scales as 1 over the mass. In other words, if you imagine that you look at a density fluctuation on the QCD horizon scale, this is the fluctuations are of order 1. If you look at 100 times the QCD horizon scale, the fluctuations are going to be 1 over 100 square root, in other words, 1/10 of average size 0.1, okay? So that means you go to sufficiently large scales, these density fluctuations have become irrelevant.
Usually in the grid picture, the speed is only zero because the winds are not interacting with matter.
Yes.
So this is why we understand clumping of matter.
Yes, but the point about the issue of the gene's length is that your speed of sound or your pressure will only prevent the clumping on a small scale. Okay, so smaller than the gene's length is where the pressure prevents the coupling, and bigger than the gene's length, it can collapse anyway. And the point with axions for linear structure formation is that the scale on which it can prevent the clumping is much smaller than the scale on which you care about growing fluctuations.
So this is a way of distinguishing between WIMPs and axions.
If you could observe on such small scales. And the problem is that it's 0.1 kiloparsec today or something. This scale on which the fluctuations are order one is. Yeah, okay, I don't remember which one.
10 to the minus 4 parsec.
This one today is 10 to the minus 4. Yeah, I think what I need to answer the question is the gene's length today, and I don't.
0.1
parsec.
Yeah.
So unobservable to take.
The sun is 8 parsecs from the center of the galaxy. Thank you. It's only two syllables. No, we don't want to look at that. Okay, so now we get to the interesting question. That where axions might be different from WIMPs is nonlinear structure formation. Okay, where pressures are irrelevant for linear, but they aren't irrelevant for nonlinear. So let me now, I've lost my equation, my field equations for the axion. I'll come back to them in a second. And if I consider the equations I get from taking the divergence of the stress energy tensor, which are equivalent to the field equations, I have a continuity equation, which basically just says mass conservation I'm not going to be interested in. And then I have an Euler equation. And so basically what's on the left-hand side here is acceleration times the density. And on the right-hand side are forces. So there's a gravitational force that tries to collapse stuff. And then there will be extra forces due to the pressures from the field. And so I think if you really want to know whether axions are different from WIMPs, what one needs to do is hack a gadget or Ramsey's or something, and run dark matter as a fluid and compare it to N-body, which treats dark matter in phase space. Okay? Now, maybe before one does that, you want to try and understand something analytically. So here's my equation back, and I actually wrote my extra terms. So remember I said the two extra pressures I was going to get due to the axion field were a gradient term and a self-interaction term, and there they are. And this now looks like fluid mechanics. I'm a long way from my initial field. So let's remind ourselves why these are the same thing. So if I start out with my axion field, it's a real scalar and it satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation, then I want to take the non-relativistic limit. And when I do that, it becomes a complex field because now I have the number of particles is going to be conserved in the non-relativistic limit. So I trade my axion field A for something I'm going to call phi, and phi is now a complex field. I write it as a modulus times a phase. The modulus is the square root of the density that sits up here. The gradient of the phase is going to be the velocity of my fluid. Okay? And because when I take the non-relativistic limit, I have these funny facts that the mass dimensions change. I have these funny factors of mass that float around. the coefficient of the self-interaction has gone from being a dimensionless thing I called lambda before to what I now call g, and it's proportional to 1 over f squared. And remember, f was 10 to the 11 jev. Now, the point is that g is negative. Okay. Now, I'm not very good with minus signs, so the way I want to take care of that is to take the absolute value of g and put the minus sign explicitly. And obviously, the gravitational force on my density fluctuation in axions is going to go inwards. This term is also inwards. And the point is that the density falls off with radius. So you take the gradient of something that falls off with radius, and it is also going to point inwards. Okay? So the only outwards pressure I have with axions is from the gradient. Now, let me emphasize what was already said. The point of the relevant point of where we describe the axion as a field or as a fluid is that fluids are single valued, right? So if you have two pieces of fluid who have different velocities who meet, you form a shock. Whereas if you have two particles in phase space with different velocities who come to the same point, they just cross, right? That's what your phase-based distribution tells you, is how many particles of what different velocity are present at a given point. Now, these equations have been widely studied by a lot of people in different contexts. So most of the studies of galaxy solutions focus on values of the mass where you naturally get a solution which has the size of a galaxy today, in other words, about 10 to the 12 solar masses. I'm interested in the QCD axion. So I want to know what kind of solutions I might get to this equation if I put in the QCD axion parameters. And so one way to do that is to take approximate analytic solutions and see what values you get for the radius and the density. Now, it turns out you get more or less the same answer by just waving your hands. So let's do it that way. So here's my Euler equation, where I've canceled a density. So on the left-hand side, I have accelerations. And on the right-hand side, I have some forces. Now, I want a stable solution, so I'm going to elect the left-hand side. And then let me forget about the self-interaction term for a minute. And I want to balance gravity against the gradient pressure. And so that's fairly straightforward to do. I replace my gradient squared here by a 1 over some scale r. Balance it against that, and that gives me an estimate of the gene scale. It's going to be inversely proportional to the mass of my of axions that I'm considering. Okay, so basically, I've put here a mass of axions which is spherically symmetric of radius r, and I find that the stable radius is inversely proportional to the mass. Now, for this to be about the right estimate for the radius, the self-interactions need to be irrelevant. So let me now impose that the self-interactions are smaller than gravity. Now, both this term and that term are proportional to the density in axions, right? Because in the Newtonian potential, it's the mass of the axions inside a radius r, which is proportional to the density. So the difference between the self-interactions and gravity is that the self-interactions are local, whereas gravity is long range. So at constant density, the most important thing for gravity is the matter that's far away. So I can make gravity dominate over the self-interactions if my mass is sufficiently big. So I get a lower bound on the radius. And then, so now I had two initial variables, which were the density or the mass of my object and its radius. So, and I have two equations and I can solve, and my radius is tiny. It's sort of 10 to the minus 3 of a solar mass. And my The mass of my object is even more tiny. It's about 10, don't miss this minus sign, it's 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. So I'm a very, very long way from a rotating disk galaxy. So now let me speculate. So now, remember, this is the part of my talk that is confusion and progress. So now I can only speculate. Let me speculate. We're going to back up to those mini cluster things that were order one fluctuations in the axion density. And we're going to suppose that they just stay order one fluctuations in the axion density until the matter density is of order the radiation density, because before that, it's the radiation density that controls what the universe does. As soon as a matter radiation equality, they are going to basically decouple from the Hubble flow and collapse. However, remember, they contain about 10 to the minus 8 solar masses. That's four orders of magnitude more than my stable clumps want to be. So this thing is going to start to collapse. The initial gravitational binding energy that it's losing as it collapses has got to go somewhere. And the only place it can possibly go is gradients. So the speculation is what this thing is going to do is fragment into the little stable lumps. Okay. Now, if it does that, then unfortunately, I think this might mean that axion dark matter is going to look exactly like WIMPs, because what it's going to end up being made of is these little clumps that weigh 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. So it's a bit bigger than your favorite.
More like the
machos? I think macros is, I think it's smaller than a macho. I think a macho is a 10 to the minus. I think there's a thing called a macro, which is in this range.
Use, then you cannot detect it the usual way.
So, and if you can then do some back of the envelope estimate of how many there are, and an astronomical unit is the distance from us to the sun. Okay? So there are about 10 to the minus 6 of them in a volume that would be the size of us to the sun cubed. So if this were true, maybe large-scale structured data is not how you tell the difference between axions and WIMPs. However, I think to confirm this, one has to do numerics, and we haven't done it yet. Okay, so now I'm finished. The QCD axion is a nice dark matter candidate because it was introduced to solve the strong CP problem. It avoids all lab and astrophysics bounds for masses below 10 to the minus 2 electron volts, and can give the right density of cold dark matter for a mass of about 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. Now, if you...
By the way, what did you make the distinction between the classical misalignment field and the axions produced by strings? Because the axions produced by strings, by the time you reach today and they are time to fall into galaxies, they still the velocity has been redshifted to death. So they're basically super cold. But so why do you treat them differently? In principle, if you were to look at the misalignment field, there is still some tiny velocity distribution because they are particle in the box. So there's always something of order Hubble set in some velocity distribution. So there's always some, they are not exactly monochromatic.
Because I think the what the strings are going to produce is a contribution to the two-point function, in the sense that you have what behave like random sources in different places. So I don't think it has the coherence to be a classical field.
I don't know what you mean. because when you talk about classical field, you can say how what is the length of the phase coherence. So we treat the way you treat, you can think about a classical field the way you treat about the laser field. So all it has to do is the occupation number, how many you have per the Broglie wavelength. This is the transition.
This is the crucial issue.
Yes, you're assuming that there you have long-range phase coherence. At some point, as you said, you can still treat axions at large scales as a particles, but at small scales they will look different.
Yes, my expectation is that from the very beginning, I can always treat the axions produced by the strings this way.
I don't see why. Somehow you're saying that the particles that were produced by strings, even though their velocity has been redshifted to death, at velocities much lower, much smaller than the virial velocity, you're still saying that I can treat them differently in the galaxy, meaning they have a memory about how they're produced.
Okay, no. Crucial point. I'm saying I can treat them like this from the very beginning. Emphasis from the very beginning, right after the QCD phase transition until today. Whereas these guys, or my field, sorry, there's a period where this is the relevant equations. And these equations are different from those ones due to this term. So the point is, I think only the misalignment axions are contributing here.
About that term that has to do with the fact that forget about how particles are produced. If I have a huge particle in quantum wavelength, it will not be able to collapse at scales smaller than this size. I mean, this is just, I mean.
Yeah, but I don't care because.
But this is what gives that term, right?
No, because I'm not doing the 10 to the minus 22 axis.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter if it's dependent on the mass. So you're saying that for particles, you're still saying that for particles that have of the same mass of the axion that comes from misalignment and the axion that comes from strings, one will be able to collapse at scales smaller than their size and the other
this is
not.
This is not the size of an axion.
No,
axion is a
yeah, because
meters.
Yes, but this has to do with the virial, still with the Broglie wavelength, because that what enters there is a factor of V, which is the virial velocity of the axion in the structure. So the basic thing is that the Broglie wavelength of the particle. So you're saying there are particles with the same, for the axions, there are some particles that can collapse to structures smaller than the Broglie wavelength. This is what you're saying, because they remember how they were produced.
I mean,
even though their velocity has been redshifted to death today.
These are all tiny, tiny de Broglie wavelengths, so it doesn't matter.
This is not a question about the de Broglie. This is a principle. I can dial up. You can apply whatever. I can imagine a universe when I have a phase transition that happens very, very late. So I talk about it has nothing to do with the mass.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about anything except the QCD axiom. The point I'm trying to make is that they probably are not different today. The issue I wanted to address is whether they are, okay? So the question is, since the axion field, the field and not particles, have different contributions to the stress energy tensor, do you care? Now you're telling me today they're the same. I agree. Today they both look like that. Probably. I need to do numerics to show it, but probably. Okay. So I'm done. Thank you.
Do these clumps, you said there's like 10 to the minus 6 per solar volume or something. Have you thought about the effects on direct detection? Like if the entire of the dark matter in the galaxy is in lumps, I mean, how likely is it that we're going to pass through like a radium X just screwed, we'll never detect them? Or is it only, you know, is it only like 1% of the dark matter is actually in these clumps? I mean, what's the effect on direct detection?
I think your 1% is probably about... It might be 10%. So so then I'm into it's not physics I do, but the latest Japanese simulation that gives that you get the right relic cold dark matter density if you put the axion mass at 10 to the minus 4 electron volts is saying that there are more axions in the mess of stuff left over from strings right. than there are in the misalignments.
Let's say if you were in the anthropic scenario, where inflation's lower, now everything comes from misalignment, so now there's 100% of the dark matter in clumps. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, what's the mass spectrum of the clumps?
Yeah, now this is, then this becomes a very disturbing number.
Right.
Because if there's only, this means we don't go through one very often, so what does ADMX see?
Right, it means they're not going to see anything. If we're in the anthropic scenario,
but
and
yeah, so
everything's
really,
in that number,
ADMX
is going to see
it. Sorry, but they're tightly, I thought many of them are tightly disrupted because the gradients of the galaxy, these are very, very dilute. So if you do the estimate, I thought many of them are tightly disrupted.
So
right,
these are
that,
not the same,
right,
by
exactly,
the way,
exactly.
These are not the same mini clusters, right? The density in these mini clusters that Sasha is calculating is much larger.
Right, that, I mean, that's exactly
density.
My question. If they're tightly disrupted, then. You know, there's only going to be a small amount of these hanging around there.
Yeah,
everything
yeah,
else
these mini clusters are different than the ones you're talking about.
No. I'm also talking about not the mini clusters. The 10 to the minus 12.
The lumps. Yeah.
Not
so,
the 10
yeah,
to minus 8 mini clusters.
These are
the
very yeah. So if you do the estimate for what those lumps should be from the gene scale, they're very dilute.
Right. So what
so
fraction
the,
is tidally disrupted and what fraction remains in
the you're the structure
so
formation expert. How many, this is the smallest
right.
scale if you have dark matter clumps of
dust. What is their size? What is this 10 to the minus 12 solar mass lumps having rather?
10 to the minus 3 solar mass?
The
solar radius.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, 10 to the minus 3 solar radius, yeah. And so the Hogan and Rees tidal disruption estimate is done for a mini cluster that would be formed of axion particles. And I'm not sure the tidal disruption for a lump of field works the same way, but they're not the same thing. This is coming back to the story of what's a classical field and what is a phase-based distribution, and they treat their mini cluster as a phase-based distribution. So how you do tidal disruption of the lumps, I'm not exactly sure, but I would assume, one would expect, I haven't calculated it, one would expect that there is going to be some kind of background of kind of axion particles, but I don't know.
In order to get your astrophysics, you have to be able to fit galaxy rotation curves. So the question is whether you can get correct mass profiles to do that.
So if
axions are going to behave like a phase-based distribution of cold particles, they will work as well as n-body simulations do, and that depends on what baryons, on the effect of baryons that is being studied today, right? So it's like, if this is true, it's just like WIMPs. And whether WIMPs work is an open question depending on the baryon.
Well, it just produces the same cusp problems, whatever.
If there is a cusp problem, it would have a cusp problem too.
Okay, well, it sounds like there's more questions and more to discuss, but let's thank Sasha. So she'll be here today and the first part of tomorrow.